Out here, if you're doing nothing, you're doing everything right. Though on a cruise with Norwegian, even if you're doing nothing, you're still basking in the warm sun, enjoying the peaceful ocean waves, you're breathing. Don't forget about breathing. Definitely need to be breathing. So you get to do nothing, or everything, but you still need to be breathing. It's like really important.
Experience the difference with cruises to Alaska, the Caribbean, and Europe. Norwegian Cruise Line. It's different out here. Visit NCL.com, call your travel advisor, or 1-888-NCL-CRUISE. Norwegian Cruise Line ships registry, the Bahamas and USA.
The hybridization program was what was mentioned, creating human-alien hybrids. This is going to be a hot mess. You're not going to have an alien from another planet with a totally different biology be able to hybridize with a human. That can't happen. So if there is a hybridization program, then there are implications to that. If you can reproduce one of this craft, then you can have UFOs that can probably capable of interstellar travel. It's hard to believe that our military has done this. I don't believe that we have these craft fully reverse engineered. I think that would be silly to believe. People I've talked to who have claimed to know about these reverse engineering programs say that there's not been much figured out, and that's what I would expect to be the case. You aren't going to figure out a lot with a handful of scientists who are having to work in secret and not communicate with anyone else. You're not going to get very far.
Hi, everyone, and welcome back to That UFO Podcast. As always, my name is Andy, and returning guest today, and a very well-timed guest, I would like to think, I have Kevin Knuth. He is a physicist and professor at the University of Albany, with a background that includes working at NASA's Ames Research Center. He's one of the few scientists publicly approaching the UFO topic through data, physics, sensor analysis, and serious scientific method. Kevin's been on the show before, and I'm delighted to welcome him back to dig into where the subject stands right now, especially in the light of recent government releases. So welcome back, Kevin, to the podcast.
Wow, thank you so much for having me.
Interesting times we live in right now. And if folks want to hear all about your background, we've done that on a previous podcast and begun to barely tap, you know, what you know about this subject, your thoughts, your opinions. And I strongly recommend, Kevin, people check that out. We're going to talk about the here and now and get your expertise on that. And since we last spoke, in the last couple of weeks, there have been two big drops of files from the US government. And as someone involved in this topic through multiple different disciplines, where is the UFO UEP topic for you right now?
Well, this is certainly interesting and unprecedented. It's exciting because we don't know what's going to be disclosed. We're still not. I mean, no one really knows what the different. I'll use the word the government, but the government isn't a single entity, right? There's different. There's different groups within the government, so we don't know what each agency knows, and we don't know what's going to be released, and. So it's quite exciting and interesting, and but it's also concerning because we know that they've been keeping this secret for more than 80 years, and there's been outright lying going on for 80 years, and deception, and misinformation and disinformation. So it's very hard to know whether what's being released is going to be real information or not. How much of it is true? And that's going to be difficult to decide.
How much of release one and release two have you managed to look at from the last couple of weeks?
I've looked at a number of videos from release one, and I haven't had a chance to look at much from release two yet. Release one was not incredibly useful. They're clearly not presenting the metadata. And in fact, on some of these videos, you can see it redacted out. So, I mean, this metadata basically is the instrument data telling you what the settings are on the instrument, what the field of view is of the camera, what type of infrared imagery they're using, if it's infrared. So is white hot and black cold, or is it the other way around? They can switch that. What is the magnification scale of the camera? All of these things have been redacted out. So, scientifically, it's not useful at all. Images by themselves typically aren't useful. And So images with all the metadata taken out really aren't useful. So as a scientist, I don't find it useful. It's more just, you know, interest to see what, you know, what these things are showing and what similarities they might have to other things I know about. But that's about as far as it goes.
Just to stick with that, and I'm going to show you some of those videos from Release 2 in a short while and get your kind of immediate reactions and thoughts on it. Having had no real time or, you know, any instrumentation to look at them, you're going to just give us a very quick, you know, Kevin's thoughts off the top of his head. When you talk about metadata, though, that's really interesting because your average Joe, your average member of the public like me, sees this stuff, and I'm generally judging it purely on the eye test of what's put in front of me and is there any context given off the back of it. But like you say, as a scientist, the context you're looking for is the metadata. So just to take us there again, why is it impossible for you to judge these videos properly without metadata? What are the basic things missing that would help you look at these videos properly?
Right. Well, I mean, even with metadata, images from one camera aren't always useful. The camera is measuring angular changes of things. You don't know the distances to the objects. Without knowing the distance to the object or the speed or the size of the object, you need some kind of length scale to be able to tell how much of an angle corresponds to how much distance and at where the object is. So without knowing how far away the object is or how big the object is, you can't determine its speed, which means you can't determine its acceleration. So when the thing zips off and looks like it accelerates very fast, is that an illusion from being zoomed in so much, or is it actually accelerating at a very high rate of speed? That's not clear without a second camera and doing triangulation. Now, metadata will only get you so far. That tells you what some of the camera settings are. So it would tell you what the magnification of the camera is. And so that's sometimes helpful to determine what's going on. But usually you would need to really analyze a video of a UAP. You're going to need images from multiple cameras taken simultaneously. That would be ideal.
I just spoke to your colleague, Matthew Zhigadis. And right. that was his one wish, that he would have a video with multiple angles of the same video. And it's so simple, but it makes so much sense, doesn't it? That we, so often we get these videos, no matter how poor or incredible in terms of quality, it tends to be that one angle, and it really does miss off a lot.
Right. That's what it comes down to.
So do you think there's a danger then with government agencies that right now it appears they're trying to be transparent? Here's a website, war.gov/UFOs. Here's a directive, a statement from the president, Pete Hegseth, you know, the Secretary of War, Defence, whatever, is putting stuff out there. Here's files, videos, audio snippets. It looks like transparency on one hand, doesn't it? But they're still withholding a lot of the information that makes this genuinely interesting.
Yeah, that's part of the difficulty. Congress clearly wants transparency, and they've requested specific videos that that some of the representatives have seen. Those who have classification have seen some of these classified videos. And Representative Luna put out a list of I think 46 videos that they wanted released. They had a deadline of April 15th, I believe, that just whizzed on by, made a whooshing sound like one of Douglas Adams' deadlines. You know, Douglas Adams has this great quote. I love deadlines. I love the whooshing sound they make as they go by. And that's exactly what happened. So, that came and went. And in those videos, the representatives found them compelling, and those would be interesting to see. But it appears that so while Congress really seems to really be pushing for some kind of transparency, and the president is supporting them, and that's wonderful. The agencies are still clearly dragging their feet. They don't want to release this stuff, and one has to ask this question. I mean, it's very easy. It'll Well, let me hold on to that thought and first talk about this. So, so what are they releasing? They seem to be releasing the most uninteresting videos they have. It's gonna be interesting to see how much garbage they got before they can dump on us before they can release something meaningful. And so far, these are clearly the most uninteresting videos. The first three that came out several years ago, the three Navy videos were interesting, but again, these were videos that were not displaying the amazing characteristics of the objects. The Nimitz recording, the last 35 frames of that show the object accelerating off and the computer system losing track. Yeah. That we were able to use to get some information about that acceleration. But the descriptions that the pilots had of these behaviors of these objects were quite different. And so, and we haven't seen videos of anything like that yet. So they're not releasing the important or interesting videos yet. And right, and I had a thought that I was going to hold on to, and now I've totally lost it.
You're holding on to that thought incredibly tightly. Well, I'll tell you what, let's have a dive into some of those videos quickly from release two. I've picked out six of them here, and bear in mind, like Kevin's just said, you're looking at these generally the first time, you've not had a chance, you're saying there's no metadata, and surprise, surprise, there is no metadata here. You're going to see the screens are largely blacked out and redacted across. But I just want your quick thoughts of what am I looking at? And for those on audio, I'll tell you what video is appearing on the screen. So the first one is described as an amorphous object. And Kevin, I'll tell you what is being claimed this potentially is once you've had a look at it. I'm just showing Kevin the quick clip of the kind of figure. And what's your immediate take?
My first question would be, what is going on with the background? Is this over water? Because it's not clear what the background is, or is this into the sky? If it's into the sky, it looks incredibly zoomed in and noisy, so it's not quite clear what's going on. Amorphous object, yeah, it is kind of amorphous, but one could imagine that those could be several balloons, four or five balloons with a string hanging down. That's very possible. And especially if the object's really far away and they're really zoomed in, it's going to be very blurry like this. So it's not clear.
Well, a lot of folks are very excited about this one as a shape-shifting object. People are claiming all sorts of stuff. There are a few accounts online, including an ex-community note, saying that this is a stormtrooper balloon, a Star Wars stormtrooper balloon from 2015. And folks have even done broken down analyses of the stormtrooper balloon, how it moves, and why various times in this it's the exact shape and of the stormtrooper and the balloon. And I can see it, to be honest, whether it's that or not, but it's just interesting that I believe it's in the sky, not over the water. You say, your kind of go-to for this would potentially, at a glance, be a balloon.
Yeah, it could easily be a balloon, yeah. Yeah, that would be the first thing I would try to rule out if I was trying to study this, yeah.
Cool. But again, for anyone going, oh, Kevin and Andy are ruining it, there's no metadata, so it's hard. You're literally still having to speculate as to what this is or isn't because of a complete lack of data surrounding it.
Yeah, this the problem is us looking at this is just also speculation. So you're speculating as what this is. I would guess this is probably a balloon, but
to be fair, Kevin,
for sure.
I took some mild, there's a phrase we have here, mild flack, you know, some mild abuse, all friendly, I'm sure, for suggesting that some of these videos might not be non-human craft. David Grush himself said in the lead up to the release of these videos, he knew what was coming and they weren't particularly interesting or going to move the needle in terms of what had to be done and what he was doing. So for me, that was very telling. Not that they're all completely uninteresting, but David Grush himself said before this release he wasn't overly hopeful. So that was always something that's kept me really tempering my own expectations as someone who puts a lot into Grush. Here's a video of what looks like a sphere moving over mountainous terrain. It looks like Iraq, Afghanistan sort of area, very similar to the Mosul orb. Again, instant kind of thoughts on this one.
Oh, this is a neat video. I like this. Again, I wish there was some kind of metadata so we could get some idea of how big the object is and how far away it is, that would be wonderful. But, you know, a second camera, again, would be great. Or some kind of estimate of size if they were able to do that in some way. But without knowing that, it's hard to know. It's hard to know what it is. You know, skeptics are going to say it's a balloon, and it could very well be a balloon. it's hard to know, right? And so, you know, I would then have to say that if we've got this many videos, if the Navy is busy, or the military is busy collecting this many videos of balloons, then we have to ask what our billions of dollars are going towards.
So. That is one really good argument, though, isn't it, for people who say these can't all be balloons, that surely they are not misidentifying all of this stuff. But that's not to say that there couldn't be in amongst them. We're going to get to this, and you've kind of alluded to it, Kevin. There's a lot of noise and clutter in amongst these releases and these data dumps and document dumps.
Right.
A lot of release one was very document heavy, and a lot of those documents contain correspondence and newspaper clippings, which isn't anything classified, literally newspaper clippings of reports or UFO club correspondence and things like that. So, another video, this one was labeled as shape-shifting. So I'll put it back to the start of this one for you. So object screaming across the water here has an initial shape that does look indeed to change, but I'm curious to see what Kevin thinks of that. Almost TIE fighter or kind of star-shaped, like, initially.
Yeah, this is interesting. So, I mean, it's a good place to pause it. Do you see the dark line there and the dark line there? If you say it's over water, I'm guessing that these are wave troughs. And so I'm guessing you're able to see what the wavelengths of these waves are. If you knew how big the waves were, you could then get some idea of how far away the object is and how big it is. That would be useful. The fact that the image is so... you basically have bright, bright white in the middle without any detail, and then you've got black around it, makes me think that the detector is saturated in some way. So if this is an infrared image, the temperature range of this object is off the scale. So there's something interesting about it. We don't know what kind of image this is. Is this an infrared image or is it a visible image? I mean, I don't know if there's any metadata to describe that. That's not quite obvious. It looks like it could be an infrared image. And if that is, then the temperature of the thing is off whatever scale their temperature scale is using. But again, without the metadata, we don't know what temperature scale the instrument's using. So you're stuck. It's interesting that all of this metadata was removed. You can ask the question as to why in the three early Navy videos, not some of the metadata was actually erased off the screen, not blacked out.
Yeah, redacted, it was removed.
Yeah, it wasn't all redacted, but some of it was erased. We know that some of it is usually there. There's usually a distance to object data thing, and that was actually erased off the screen. So we know that they removed some metadata from the first three Navy videos. But these videos, it looks like they're in some cases, they're clearly removing all of the metadata. So why is that happening? I mean, they might want to remove metadata to protect the identity of the instrument or to protect information about the capabilities of their instrumentation and getting out. I mean, this is one reason that these things are kept secret. It's to protect our capabilities and keep our capabilities secret. But then you wouldn't need to redact all of the metadata. So why is that happening? Well, could it be happening because they're being lazy? And it could be that they needed to release these by a certain date. So if we redact some of it, we have to then send it back for approval, and there's a cycle there and a time delay. And so maybe they were just being quick about it. That's hard to speculate. But without knowing what the temperature scale of this image, if it is an infrared image, it's hard to know what this object even is. It does appear to be changing shape. It looks clumpy. It doesn't look like a balloon. Could it be a bunch of balloons? If it was a bunch of balloons, it would be big, and then these waves in the background would have a very long wavelength, which is a little strange to have that kind of amplitude. to get the dark and light lines. So it doesn't look like it's an exceptionally large object, but that's, again, hard to estimate.
It does seem to have quite a distinct shape, and I know you'll know better than I, but even from here, like from a sensor point of view, you can see quite a distinct, you know, points on either side, as if there's something sticking up, protruding like a dome or head in the middle. And that's why I think TIE Fighter, almost like that wing either side with something in the middle, but obviously higher up, then right. It kind of just loses it. So either it does change shape.
Now, what is these white things appearing here? That would be interesting to know as well.
I'm trying to remember off the top of my head, but it may be going through a wind farm on larger. Yeah. Some of these videos,
seeing other things in the image that you know what they are, some can help you determine scale. So that can be useful.
Yeah, but like I say, some of these videos are like 12, 15, 17 minutes long, and they're multiple times, then it changes, it shows you we've sped it up, we've moved it. So yeah, one of the more spectacular videos, and I'll use that word loosely, but I think this video is really interesting, is one that came out last year around about October time, and it shows the what seems to be a large sphere or disc moving through clouds. We're told this is shot from above the clouds looking down. What's your immediate take on this one?
That's interesting because it's clearly interacting with the clouds. It looks like the clouds are swirling around it. And that's pretty cool. I find that interesting because we know that when UAP are traveling at very high speeds, they don't seem to be interacting with the atmosphere. But this one is. So I find that interesting.
Some common debunks I'd love your thoughts on this one. Is that it's an eclipse or a shadow of a sun or a moon on the clouds.
The shadow of the moon on the clouds? No, that like wouldn't be that. The shadow of the moon's huge. The moon is thousands.
Or like the sun, people have said it's when there's an eclipse, it's like the shadow from the eclipse on the clouds and things like that.
Yeah, it can't be that, yeah.
More interesting?
We saw the solar eclipse last year. What was it? Last year, April, and we in Vermont. And you could actually see the shadow of the moon on the clouds, but because it was overcast to the south, and you could see this line of darkness that stretched from horizon to horizon, and the dark area was the shadow of the moon. And you could actually see where that was, which I thought was fascinating. But this is way too small to be the shadow of the moon. Yeah.
And I think to your point, you quite clearly see it move through the cloud. It does, as you say, it interacts, it displaces the cloud, doesn't it?
Yeah, it goes into the clouds and comes out, and it's interacting with the clouds. And so the shadows don't do that. If somebody wants to stick with the shadow story, then I'm going to have to question what they know about shadows.
That's good to know, because that's one I've got a lot more hope and promise in. This one is labelled instantaneous acceleration. Now, this is one that a lot of folks have been showing on various news items as well. And this is one that appears to have a lot of promise. Object right. Shooting along pretty bright, and then moves slightly to the left and then fires off. What appears to do, fire off at a rather
quick... Yeah, that's pretty amazing. That firing off looks pretty cool. again, you've got the... instrumentation saturated, so the camera's saturated, so you can't get any detail on the image. But the camera systems that the military uses aren't designed to take pretty pictures of objects. They're designed to track them and identify them. So you don't expect that to happen. Yeah, that's really interesting. It's again, the hard part is it's hard to know how far away the object was. And if you don't know that, you can't determine what its speed is or how it's accelerating. Now that if you freeze frame it at one point, the video is refreshing like this. You can actually see that there's a dashed line, which means that it's goes past the refreshing and then comes back again. So you can actually get some idea of how far it traveled while you can get a good idea of the angular speed of the object this way, but not the physical speed, because you need distance to object or size.
What about the moment it appears to instantaneously accelerate? Is there enough there for you to say it, there's a good chance that it does?
I mean, I wouldn't use the word, I know they like to use the word instantaneous acceleration. There's no such thing. There's just acceleration faster than you can measure is what it would be.
Yeah, okay.
Which is what, nobody wants to say that though, and it doesn't sound as cool. So, so it's, yeah, it's clearly accelerating at a very high rate, but it's hard to know what that rate is and how unreasonable it is.
And then final one, you've got three what appear to be boats or ships on the water, and an object bottom left of the screen just cruises on by.
That's
I'll put
great.
It back to the start on that one.
That's great. Now that now what I was focusing on just now was the ships. The if you know what kind of ships they are, then you know the size of the ship. And the wake size, the wake angle is going to be related to the speed of the ships in the water. So if you knew the size of the ships and you can measure the wake angle, you might be able to get the speed of the ships and the distance to the ships. Now this object is clearly closer than the ships to some degree, so it might be able to put some bounds on sizes and distances this way. But there's something funny about these ships. I'd have to look at other videos of ships, but it looks, these ships are all oriented in almost the same direction. They almost look like they were pasted onto the image, which is a little weird. Have they redacted the ships in some way? Is that a redaction that they pasted onto the ships so you can't tell what kind of ships they are? That's what it looks like. It looks like those aren't the real ships.
What's frustrating is obviously you're surmising and kind of speculating in real time. Other folks are watching that same video and claiming there are four UAP. And I'm like, no, that seems to me there are three boats in the water.
It appears to be three boats in the water. I'm guessing that there are three boats in the water and they have basically redacted the boats with black so that you can't tell what kind of boat they are.
But to your point then about transparency, is that them deliberately obfuscating, doing their job, making it out as if they're giving us something when really they're giving us very, very little to work with?
They're not giving us anything. What would my friend Tom said? Let it never be said that they didn't do the very least they could do. There it is.
I mean, in your experience, have you seen videos better than this that haven't been released?
We have better videos than that. So at this point, I think that, and we're going to see that more and more as scientists continue to collect their own data. I think we're going to see better videos and better, better evidence.
And the is at SCU?
We at UAPX.
UAPX. Cool.
UAPX, yeah.
That's something that'll come.
Right. And it's very easy to look at these and be overly critical. Just being reasonably critical will sound like overly critical because these are just the bare minimum garbage videos and all the useful information's taken out. So the one question you then would be left asking is why? What then do they have that they're not releasing, right? That you then have to, you can't help but wonder about that. I mean, so these are the not so good videos. Are they all not so good? That's very possible. I can get people are going to say, well, these can't all be balloons. Well, they could all be balloons if they're releasing the worst videos they have. They could have just said, release all the balloon videos. The next time we'll release all of the close by insects flying past the screen and the next, you know, which also look very fast. And all of the other things that can just obfuscate the situation. But then you have to ask, well, why are they doing this and why aren't they producing, you know, what aren't they showing us? And but then you're again back into the realm of speculation, which is where we've been sitting for 80 years. So it's a tough situation.
And to what extent can you say what UAPX, for example, is collecting compared to this?
I don't know yet. And we don't even know what we've all collected yet. We at UAPX, we've got a couple sites where we've got sets of cameras set up, and we've been recording 24/7 around the clock. One of them since November. So this is literally terabytes of data. How do you go through this? If you've collected 24 hours of video, you have to sit down and watch the video for 24 hours, which this is not exciting video. You're watching the sky with nothing happening for 24 hours. You know, that's horribly boring and hard to do. So we haven't reviewed all of this. Now, Matthew Shadagas, who you talked to recently, has developed some machine learning software that he calls Custom Target Analysis Protocol, CTAP. And this actually identifies objects for us that are objects of interest and notes when they happen in the video, and actually takes video segments and pulls them out so that we can look at the segments. And so that right now, that software can run a little faster than real time. So
okay.
It'll take maybe 20 hours for it to analyze a 24-hour video. So we're not that much better, but we're getting there. And so we have a challenge for storing all of this information. We actually have a donation website set up, and with the university, and we're hoping to get funds because we need literally hundreds of terabyte storage to store this information. And then we have need computers to analyze the data and to highlight things for us. We already have had a few videos that we've seen, and we know what we took when we were there physically watching the sites. I don't know how much Matthew talked about it. He spent 5 days at a site in Connecticut. I was there for one night, and then I had to go back and finish publishing one of our UAP papers. But
we didn't get into it. Matthew had a limited, we had like 40 minutes, 45 minutes to talk, and we didn't get to that, unfortunately.
Oh, we didn't get to that, right. Yeah. So he actually had seen some of these glowing orbs. He took the time to look at one of them through a telescope, and said that it looked like this giant ball of plasma and was pretty amazing. But we've got videos of some of these other orbs, which is interesting. But we haven't had a chance to analyze all of that yet. And we're still working on collecting data. So.
And categorically, these orbs are not satellites or things in the sky or.
No, they're hovering over trees and over water. Yeah.
I'm famously skeptical of a lot of orb videos being satellites or space station because
yeah,
they get
a lot
shown
of times,
online. And,
yeah, looking up in the sky, it's very hard to distinguish satellites and things from. In fact, we had that problem when we filmed A Terra in the Sky in Catalina. The first white object that's seen, the first bright light that the Catalina group saw that we tracked turned out to be the space station. So, yeah, it's hard
to do.
It's easy to make a mistake.
But the credibility you earn from that is acknowledging what you filmed was indeed something prosaic, something actually quite incredible.
No, it turned out to be very useful when we wrote up our scientific paper. It was very useful because it showed that we're performing due diligence. We're actually researching and actually studying, actually trying all the hypotheses to see what it could be, and we found that that was actually the space station. Actually, Matthew did that. Part of the analysis, it was his hypothesis that it was the space station, and he really tracked that down. He did a fantastic job. He actually used the pixel size on the camera, on the iPhone camera, used the number of pixels that the light took up, and knowing the distance to the space station, used the pixel size to estimate how big the space station would be, and he was off by 1 foot.
That's not bad.
He basically measured the size of the space station from an iPhone camera picture is what he did, which was brilliant physics work. It's very nice.
I just think with stuff like that, you're more likely to get people like me, and I can't speak for everyone, but I'm sure quite a portion of the audience listening and watching will look at an organization then like UAPX with more interest in the data, because not only are they releasing or going to release interesting footage, images, but it's also going to be well-researched and filtered, and you yourself can say, ah, this is actually, like you say, the space station, and not just block everyone who accuses you of trying to, you know, which happens a lot online when folks release videos and they get accused of, actually, it might be this. Oh, I don't believe you, block. And, well, where's the science? Where are you trying to filter the wheat from the chaff here? Because 90%, 95% of these sightings, videos, are probably misidentifications, adversarial technology, US technology, planes, birds, balloons. But the 5% are incredible. That's what we need to focus on. Not right. All the other stuff. People are desperate for it to be something that it's not.
And that's really true. And that's why, a lot of the work that we've been doing has ended up showing that what was filmed or what the people had supposedly had evidence for turned out to be prosaic. And, you know, we found that a lot of it's prosaic, and then had people upset with us. Oh, no, you have to support us. You know, you have to help, you know, you should be supporting this work. But if it's not a UAP, it's not a UAP. We're looking for the truth here. And the last thing we need is to be distracted by a bunch of things that aren't actually alien spacecraft. You will never get to the truth that way. It's actually far better to perform the opposite error, where you happen to exclude some actual alien spacecraft, so that you can get a good sample of other ones that you can clearly tell are and can study them. That's what we would like to do.
I want to talk about the terminology and language for a moment from your perspective, because this is something that I did talk about a lot with Matthew. Now, we're seeing people like David Grush, Lou Elizondo, again, just in the last couple of days on the news, saying the US government, and again, it's a big word, it's you know, multiple compartments, have in their possession materials of non-human origin. As a scientist, what do you need to see before the phrase non-human origin means anything scientifically?
What they typically mean by non-human origin is it means that it's not coming from a human from our present culture.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's probably the clearest way to put it. It's not made by a human on Earth at this time. Right? As you know, as Michael Masters has put forward the hypothesis that these could be time travelers from the future, some of them could very well be time travelers from the future. We can't rule that out. But right now they're being grouped under the term non-human, right? Non-present day human might be a better way to put it. And I think that's all you can say right now. You can't say that think of what kind of evidence would you need to be able to prove that some of these guys are from the Pleiades. Hmm. And to say they're from the Pleiades is already suspect. It's already problematic, because clearly the person who's saying this doesn't know what the Pleiades is. The Pleiades is a star cluster. It's a cluster of stars, right? Which is a bunch of stars, light years apart from each other. Now, they're saying they're coming from a star cluster. That's not, well, which star? I mean, that would be the most, they're not telling you which star they come from. They're telling you which cluster. And why are they identifying that cluster as being important, right? The Pleiades, you could make some arguments because it's an open cluster and those stars all formed from the same cloud of gas, presumably, but so there, that might make some sense. But to say they're from the Pleiades, it would be a very strange thing to say. And of course, where do they get that? How do they know we call it the Pleiades?
How comfortable then are you with that terminology you mentioned, non-human intelligence? For most people in the general public, they hear alien. You know, something that's not us, another higher intelligence, and we assume higher intelligence because of methods and, you know, assumptions. But based on the evidence we do have, which may be limited publicly, there may be exposure, maybe scientists like yourself and others have a different level of exposure. There are then other levels beyond that, no doubt, where you go to your David Grushy's. And again, beyond that, if you look at your General Neil McCaslin, who's now been missing since February, a lot of folks would point to the general and say that as someone who was working on advanced technology, advanced propulsion, would have been a guy really in the know. What are you comfortable in saying? Are you comfortable hypothesizing time travel? Do you still think alien or interdimensional is on the table? What do you go to?
All right. Wow. This is multiple things to hit here. I'm less comfortable with time travel than I am with the other hypotheses, because you've got to throw time travel into the mix, which is a whole other thing, right? So using Occam's razor, I try to focus on the simpler hypotheses, and hypotheses not involving time travel are probably simpler. It doesn't mean you can rule them out. I mean, you've got Occam's razor. You need to find the simplest explanation that satisfies all of the evidence. So you need to take into account the evidence. Interdimensional, let's hit that one. There are three spatial dimensions and one time dimension, and we have all of the evidence, all of the experimental evidence we have points to this. We have theoretical derivations as to why this is. There are no other dimensions. I don't believe in interdimensional in that sense. What I would ask somebody who is using the word interdimensional, I would ask them, what is a dimension? And I think you'll very quickly find out that they don't really know what a dimension is. So that term is, again, this catch-all term that is being used to describe something that can be here and then not here somehow, mm-hmm. and then be over there. So there are other ways you can have something that looks interdimensional but wouldn't be interdimensional. So there are other physics ways to do this. One of them is, so you can think of dark matter is one possibility. So dark matter, about 85% of the mass of the universe is made of this material that we don't even know what it is. When we just collectively call it dark matter. And there's dark matter in this room. 85% of what's here is dark matter. You can't see it. You can't feel it. You don't interact with it except gravitationally. That's it. Just a gravitational interaction. And so it isn't about, people often go to, oh, it's seeing, you only see a limited part of the spectrum. No, it's bigger than that. It's more impressive than that. So there could be an entire dark matter environment right here in this room with living beings made of dark matter that I don't interact with at all physically, except gravitationally. And the gravitational interaction between me and this chair here is small, so I wouldn't notice it.
I want to ask you just something on that. This might be a really stupid question. It's a great chance of it. Could we be something else's dark matter beings then? Could someone else have a similar existence to this?
Oh, and they don't interact with us either. That's true, yes. So for them, we're the dark matter.
Right? Yeah.
It would be the opposite. The interesting thing that I find about the whole dark matter problem is if there is a dark matter universe here in this room, 85% of what's in this room is dark matter. And it's in this room physically. It's in this dimension, but you don't interact with it. And so somebody might call that interdimensional, but that's not what interdimensional would mean,
okay,
technically. But for let's say you were a dark matter creature, we're only 15% of the universe. We're the anomaly.
Yeah.
When you think of the universe as a whole, most of the universe is actually the stuff we just call dark matter because we don't know anything about it. And it's not dark. You see through it, right? It's transparent. It doesn't interact with photons. So, but the 15%, which is what we're all made of, the whole universe is actually an anomaly, which I think is kind of fascinating. So everything that we think of as prosaic and normal is actually, to somebody else, would be an anomaly.
We are the UFO. We are the UFO to something else. We are the unidentified.
We are the weird things, yeah. We're the weird things in the universe. Yeah, I think that's a funny thought.
And it's interesting then that you hear folks like Anna Paulina Luna is saying interdimensional a lot on the news, you know, in interviews and things like that, and this terminology. But maybe we're at a stage where it doesn't really matter to your average member of the public. They're just trying to get the terminology out there, and the maybe just the idea, not the terminology.
They're going for the idea that it doesn't move and behave the way that we think of things moving and behaving. I think that's what they're trying to convey. But as a scientist, we struggle because we then have people who are more with a more scientific bent who then try to use that literally, and it's like, no, that you don't take it. This is not being used as a technical term.
And then if we've covered off time travel, interdimensional, what about ET?
Extraterrestrial, that's another hypothesis, and it's a reasonable hypothesis. And in fact, it is possible to travel to other star systems. It is very far away, but these craft, the speeds and accelerations that we have measured and have estimated, and we have I have a scientific paper on this, show accelerations on the order of 5,700 Gs. In the Nimitz case, you had the Tic Tacs at 28,000 feet and they dropped down to sea level in 0.76 seconds. That acceleration to accelerate halfway and then decelerate the other half is 5,700 Gs, which is crazy, crazy high. What would 1,000 Gs get you? 1,000 Gs would give you such an acceleration that if you could sustain it in space for some time, you would get to 90% the speed of light in 17 hours. So you take off at 1,000 Gs, and we already know UAP can go accelerate six times faster than that. But if you accelerate it not 1,000 Gs, you'll be going 90% the speed of light in 17 hours. You're then traveling at a relativistic speed where time goes slower and space contracts and all of this sort of thing. And you can travel those distances. Now, for everybody else in the galaxy watching this happen, they see, it's going to take a 1,000 years for them to travel 1,000 light years. But for the traveler is going to get there in a few days. So
it seems like a very short distance to travel such an excessive speed. And I wonder, what do you think around that? Because it just seems 28,000 feet in that time.
Yeah, why are they going so fast over those short distances? That's a good question. Yeah. And this isn't new, by the way. So if you accelerate halfway down, 5,700 G acceleration, and then so you would do that for what's half of 28,000, 14,000 feet. And then the last 14,000 feet, you decelerate. At the midpoint, you're traveling about 40,000 miles an hour. And Hermann Oberth he's a rocketry pioneer. He was the mentor to Wernher von Braun. And in the early 1950s, he gave a talk on UFOs, and he mentioned that they have measured their speeds with radar to be very high. And he describes their speed as being on the order of 19 kilometers a second. And if you do the conversion, this is about 40,000 miles an hour. So right now, the New Horizons probe that we sent to Pluto, and that flew past Pluto in 2015, right now is traveling about 40,000 miles an hour. So we know that UFOs travel at spacecraft speeds. We already know. Hermann Oberth knew this in the 1950s, which means other people knew this in the 1950s. He said he had seen over 50 radar measurements of these speeds and believed them. So this has been known that these things could be spacecraft since the 1950s. So this whole, they could be Russian or Chinese, it's silliness. This has been going on a long time, and they've known for a long time that these things are very advanced. I'm now forgetting what my point was. I have a tendency to do that. I just go on and don't stop, and then I forget what I'm thinking.
Because what I want to do, before we run out of time, there's a few more things I want to get to. I'd love to, tying that in, so thinking of the craft, one of the holy grails of this topic for anyone involved is the idea of crash retrieval programs and reverse engineering.
Right.
Again, I've got a physicist on. What do you start to think about when you hear that we have retrieved craft intact and in part and potentially reverse engineered it? Where do you, and I use the word realistically, what could we realistically do with advanced technology like that? And what are the limitations we'd perhaps come up against?
Well, I mean, what we could do is over a large range. I mean, if you can reproduce one of those craft, then you can have UFOs that can probably are capable of interstellar travel. So it's hard to believe that our military has done this because we don't use any of this in warfare. If you believe, you know, what evidence seems to be out there, what people claim, we've been collecting these crafts since 1947. So even if they have four or five of them, which is probably a pretty reasonable estimate, it's a reasonable estimate, assuming that that's been going on. Let me be a little more careful with my language. So even if you have that, you would expect that, you know, if they were able to reverse engineer a propulsion system like that, you would expect it to be used in a war. If the Russians hadn't, they wouldn't be losing in Ukraine. If we had it, we wouldn't be struggling with Iran. And they would have shown up in the Iraq War. So I don't believe that we have these craft fully reverse engineered. I think that would be silly to believe. I think more likely we have been able to reverse engineer some of the materials that the craft is made of. Materials analysis is not an easy thing to do. It's an easier thing to do than it is to figure out how something made of many alien parts is put together to work as a whole. Mm. That's harder to do. So I think the easiest thing to do would be reverse engineering some of the materials that these craft are made of. And some of that could easily have been done already.
So you had said something interesting elsewhere. I believe it was on Jesse Michael's American Alchemy, that one of the more believable things you had heard from people claiming knowledge of reverse engineering efforts was basically, we haven't figured it out. And does that correlate for you that they know bits, but they don't know the sum of the parts?
Yeah, I think that's probably, that seems to be the most reasonable assessment. I mean, people I've talked to who have claimed to know about these reverse engineering programs say that there's not been much figured out, and that's what I would expect to be the case. You aren't going to figure out a lot with a handful of scientists who are having to work in secret and not communicate with anyone else. You're not going to get very far. That's hard to do.
Where would we expect to see that technology realistically again first? If the US has had craft since 1947, and let's say they have had multiple craft, maybe 10, 15 of these over an 80-year period they've discovered in various different forms, where are the fingerprints of that showing up in society now?
Well, there are claims that some of these materials have found their way already into things that we use. So Philip Corso worked with the CIA, I believe, and he wrote a book about what happened after the Roswell crash. So his job at the CIA was to take, according to him in this book, was to take parts from these alien craft and give them to companies to reverse engineer certain aspects or to examine certain aspects of the craft. And he claims that Kevlar came from that. There have been claims that nitinol is an alloy, a metal alloy that reforms its shape. You can actually bend it to a different shape and then it will reform back to the way it was. There's claims that came from crash craft, fiber optics. So there have been claims that some of our technologies that we developed in the 60s actually came from crashed UFOs. Is that really true? Who knows? I don't know.
And again, if we do have these craft and reverse engineering has been reasonably successful, extreme power, gravity, inertia, space-time effects, are those things you could even commercialize?
Not sure you could. That's a good question. Yeah, I don't know how that would go. And even the things that have been claimed to be commercialized, that's hard because in some of those cases, there is a scientific paper trail of how they were developed. So that would argue against them coming from crashed UFOs. So most of those probably didn't come from crash craft, I would have to say. You know, you'd have to look and see what that paper trail looks like. Yeah. And I remember the one other thing that I had on the list. We were talking about non-human intelligence and why why they're not going with aliens. And the reason is because it is very probable that the non-humans live here. They clearly respond to when there's natural disasters or especially nuclear disasters, there will be UFOs there the next day. Mm. 24 hours. Within 24 hours, you'll have UFOs present. And in fact, I think it was General Yeremenkov from the Soviet Union had said that the Soviets used to do naval exercises. They would perform naval exercises where they move large portions of their fleet around, and they did that to get UFOs to come. So they would move their ships, and then UFOs would show up, and they would then study the UFOs. So they were using it to get the UFOs to come so they could study them. So if they're getting here in 24 hours, they're not coming from another star system. They're coming from our solar system somewhere. So they have to live within the solar system and very probably live here on Earth. There's been, you know, a large number of sightings of UAP going into water and coming out of water in our oceans. And some of these places in the oceans appear to be hotspots. And so that you very well could have them living underwater and we would never know it. So I think that's a real possibility. So the question then is, are the aliens who came, who discovered Earth and came here and built bases underwater, or are they another species that evolved here on Earth like we did, and we just haven't realized that they exist yet? So they an undiscovered animal on Earth that we haven't discovered, that we haven't realized. So I think this, so there's a hesitance to call them alien. We don't really know who they are and what's going on here.
What's your take on the idea then that some, because I think there's a likelihood there's various phenomena at play when you look at the types of objects, the saucers potentially coming from further away or somewhere else. It just seems too convenient. They would all be from somewhere else or all be from here. And various objects that the Navy is interacting with, for example, or the Tic Tacs and objects going in and out the water, perhaps would be unmanned. And I use the term manned loosely. And they would be another civilization or entity's drones, almost like a planetary defense mechanism, something that maybe was here a long time ago and left. And they left these things behind in a kind of Wall-E type scenario. I'm sure you've seen Wall-E back in the day.
Oh, yeah.
And it just means like, so if you've got a nuclear disaster, if you've got nuclear carrier fleets going around the oceans, these things come up and it's almost like an antibody. It's a reaction to an issue that's happening on the surface of the planet. Right. Would that make any sense?
Yeah, that's possible too. There's so many hypotheses about what could be happening here, and many of the it could turn out that several of these hypotheses turn out to be true. We don't have a taxonomy for UAP yet, so that's hard to know. Another possibility is that you had an earlier human culture that was here 20,000 years ago, or something like that, before the last ice age. And they developed space travel and left. And now we're coming back. That could be the case too. So they could be humans. They could be humans from a long time ago coming back to Earth. You can come up with all sorts of great sci-fi stories trying to put this together, right? Or look at a bunch of great sci-fi stories to try to put this together. Yeah. I think we've got whatever this is going to be end up being the case, I think it's going to be quite surprising and exciting.
Yeah, I love the idea that all these hypotheses can't be correct, but they could all be wrong. and it could be something completely off the table, and we all go, ah, oh, none of that.
Oh, we never thought of that. Holy cow. Yeah, it could very well be that too. Yeah.
Yeah,
people really haven't given this problem serious scientific thought yet. And I think that's part of what we're going to see some surprise because of that.
Yeah, so on that then, to start wrapping up, Kevin, as a scientist, working with SCU, working with UAPX, working in the various organizations and the people you've worked with, what for you then would a serious UAP data release look like? Given what we're living through right now, what for you would raise your eyebrows?
What would be ideal and interesting would be for the government to release data on something that they need help figuring out, where they actually provide the real data. Let's say they want something reverse engineered, or if they have videos of something, how is this propulsion work? And they give you all the videos and measurements that they took, and they send this out, they make it public and let the scientists around the world look at this and try to figure it out. That would be ideal. Why not? You would have scientists from all over the world jumping on the problem, and it would be figured out. If they collected the right kind of data, it would be figured out pretty quickly, I think, some of these questions, or that at least they'd have reasonable ideas would come up. And so they could get help this way, free help. Why not? Or, create grants and funding opportunities and provide them with data and have them analyze it. That would be ideal too. And you could also check people by putting out information and data on things that they've already figured out to see what people say or what other scientists say. That would be useful as well. So as a check, I think something to get the scientific community involved would go a long ways.
And I fear you've sort of answered your own question there around why not, because you said scientists all around the world. Is the issue here that the United States, and I'm guessing China and Russia, don't want China and Russia to
get it. Yeah, that's a hard one. Yeah. That's tough. I mean, the Tic Tacs move fast enough to be able to get from New York to London in less than 5 minutes. You could get from New York to Moscow in less than 5 minutes at 40,000 miles an hour. And so now you've got, and that's faster than taking a taxi across Manhattan the short way, right? East west. You could get a taxi. You could have a Tic Tac taxi taking you from New York to London or New York to Paris faster than you could get a yellow cab to take you across Manhattan. That would be fantastic. But you can't have everybody having that technology because everybody could go everywhere. Borders are gone. It's horribly disruptive. And I think it's a real concern. It is a concern. You would have to figure out how to manage it before it was released. And you wouldn't be in control of the release. So it's tough.
And if they could move that speed, it would just take a fleet of Tic Tacs to be installed with nuclear weapons and
You could deliver a weapon before anybody knew it was even launched. Yeah.
Yeah, that's that.
Incredibly dangerous, yeah.
So are you encouraged right now by the direction of travel for the UFO topic? Where do you think things are as we get towards the end of May 2026?
I'm encouraged by it, and I'm concerned about it. We don't know what's actually going on yet. And some of it appears to be disturbing and could be disruptive. And so I'm not sure where it's going to go. So it's encouraging, but at the same time, I'm expecting there to be a lot of misinformation and disinformation thrown in, and I don't know how that's going to play out. One of the things I was worried about was the abduction phenomenon. And that's already been mentioned now by, I think Burchett mentioned it, and Matt Gaetz mentioned it, and Elizondo mentioned it. So this is part of it too, that the hybridization program was what was mentioned, the alien hybrid, creating human-alien hybrids. Now, That one's going to hit hard, because that's hard even among UFO people, right? The UFO community has a hard time with that one. The general public, this is going to be a hot mess. But I think it might not be as messy as some people might think it is, because we're calling it the alien hybridization. You're not going to have an alien from another planet with a totally different biology be able to hybridize with a human. That can't happen. There's no way that's going to happen. We don't have enough biologists involved with UAPs yet to be able to say these things with any clarity. And I'm a physicist. I can provide some clarity, but not the way a biologist could. But the chance that an alien species is going to be using DNA to replicate is probably very slim. We don't know what their chemistry could be. Their chemistry is probably very different. And even if you do have DNA on both planets, you can't hybridize a human with a plant. We're too distant from each other. You can't hybridize a human with a frog. That's not going to work either. So if there is a hybridization program, then there are implications to that. One implication is they have to be using DNA. The non-humans have to be DNA-based, right? That means their biology has to basically be like ours at the chemical level, right? Which basically implies that they're from Earth. They're very likely from Earth. So now you've ruled out some possible hypotheses, such as the extraterrestrial hypothesis, probably ruled out. So are they a species that evolved here on Earth? Possibly. But then they'd have to be similar to humans, which they're not going to be ocean dwelling if they're related to humans. So now the question is, what's actually going on if there is a hybridization program? And this is why you then come back to the two of the other possibilities. One, the time traveling humans from the future, that's possible, or humans from the past coming back. Both could be possible. And so then they're not humans hybrid. Then they're humans hybridizing with humans, not aliens hybridizing with humans. So that, at least language-wise, is a little more palatable, I think, to the public than the aliens hybridizing with humans, which is terrifying in my mind. So, but again, I don't think the problem is we don't really know to what extent any of this is real or is going on or is known. And so this disclosure is a wild card. It's one of these things that there's very little control over what's going to be released. My guess is the difficult parts aren't going to be released, and there's going to be more questions than answers by the time this is done. But I'm hoping we'll get some answers. And I'm hoping that we'll get enough answers to know that this is an important thing that should be studied by the scientific community. I think that's important, because once you get scientists studying this, we'll start to learn things.
And that's why events like the Scientific Coalition for UAP Studies, SCU, have their conference, and that is at July 24th to the 26th in Toronto, right, Canada. Do you want to just tell us a little bit about that and what's happening?
Yeah, so at the end of July, the Scientific Coalition for UAP Studies is having their annual conference. In the past, it's been held at down in Huntsville, Alabama, near Redstone Arsenal, but they've moved it to Toronto, Canada this year. And you've got scientists from all over the world at this point coming to present some of their work on UAPs. And so I think my colleague Matthew Shadagas, I think, is talking about the work we've been doing with UAPX. I'm going to be giving a talk on energy and power estimates from some of these things to get some idea of what types of energies you're dealing with. And that highlights pretty quickly that these are not traditional human craft. They're not drones, they're not balloons. They're really weird. And there are a number of other talks so it goes on for 3 days, and those talks are usually recorded and then put online, and you can go to the SCU's website and see older talks from the previous years online. I think it's been going since what is it, since 2018 now or something? So it's been going for, what, 6 years or something now. So you've got several years of videos you can watch.
Excellent. Well, listen, I will put the links to that in the chat, folks. It's one of those conferences that I would love to attend and get to meet some of the folks like yourself, hear what's going on, see the work that's being done, because it is really important, especially in a time when the public is getting so much information and overwhelmed with information, to know that there are scientists, real genuine scientists, looking to work and get involved in this. And they're having to sort through, like I say, noise and clutter. And organizations like SCU are doing a great job with that. So all the best, and enjoy the conference, Kevin.
Thank you. Thank you so much. Yeah, I'm impressed by how the public is interested in this. The war.gov website with the videos apparently has had like a billion.
In about a week, it was 1 billion views, 1 billion hits.
Views. Yeah. I'm like, how did 1/10 of the population of the planet get to watch this before I did? What was I doing last week? Oh, my God.
You know, to be fair, Kevin, I think that was a large part of the UFO community constantly refreshing the website over and it's over probably, and over again.
Yeah, so, I hope that's the case. But
it was probably about 5,000 people looking at it over and over again. But no, it's certainly caught the imagination.
That one guy watching it a billion times. You know?
Absolutely. It's caught the imagination.
There was an article, my friend Barbara Thompson, who was in grad school with me. She's a project scientist at NASA. For the Solar Dynamics Observatory, but she had a clipping from a British newspaper, and it said someone buys a Barry Manilow album every second in London or something like this, and she had pasted that on her door, and she put a note on it that said, "Somebody's got to stop that guy."
So. It sounds about right. Kevin, I've got one final question, and it's an either or for you. Are we finally getting disclosure, or are we getting just enough information to argue over forever?
Oof. In one sense, it's both, right? It's a tough one, and so it's hard to do either or. In some sense, we are getting disclosure. We're getting disclosure in the sense that this is clearly something important to our national security, something that they've spent time on. You don't collect these videos, don't just get collected. People have jobs and duties, and they are paid for them. So there are programs to pay for them. So if videos got collected, there was a program to collect them. So this was all done intentionally, and it was kept quiet intentionally for 80 years now at this point. So in that sense, we have some kind of disclosure. We have a disclosure that what's going on with these objects, these unknown objects, is important. That's what you can be certain about. And it's been going on since the late 1940s. So they're not all just Russian and Chinese. It's not that simple. I think if that's that we can be certain about having disclosure on. What exactly they are and what their intentions are, what they're all doing here, that whether we get disclosure on that yet or not, I don't know.